John, you've been playing steel drums since you were 9, but the impression I get at this point in your career is that what you're trying to do is, one, bring the attention of steel drums to the public, and two, help, I guess I could use the word legitimize it.
Oh, yeah. I think you're pretty accurate with that open statement. The steel band music, as you may already know, originated in Trinidad and the West Indies. And for a very long time, it was regarded as a very local type of innovation. It was kept strictly local for a very long time because the music that they played was more or less related to the national tendencies of the country. For example, they played lots of music like the calypso style. And you will agree that that type of music, although loved by many people who visit the Caribbean, or by people who like to have light recordings of a different type, would not be the real way to go if we want to make this thing of general applicability. So what I was forced to do was to see whether I could separate for a brief moment the music itself from the instrument and present the instrument to different cultures and let them interpret it in their own way.
Yeah, well, what's happened with steel drums is I think I can include myself in this, that a lot of us have associated steel drums as the instrument that you use to play steel drum band music with, the stuff that you came from Trinidad.
Yeah.
And you don't use it to play jazz, and you don't use it to play classical music,
yeah.
And you don't use it in any of the other forms of music that any of us listen to. And you're trying to say, well, this is an instrument, and it has the potential to play different forms of music as any other instrument does.
Well, yeah, sure, definitely. That's what I'm trying to get at, because the music that the steel band players from Trinidad played was, of course, the type of music that they knew and were accustomed to. And for it to be interpreted by other people of other countries and other musical styles, they just have to forget the fact that the music that they ever heard on it was all calypso or Latin music, for that matter. The music doesn't have anything to do with the instrument itself, nor with its capabilities or potentialities. The type of music you heard from the steel band was just due to the fact that that's the type of music of Trinidad, the country where it originated.
How did it originate? How did the instrument take shape?
Okay, now, you always notice that no one could really pinpoint who was the first person to have created a musical sound from the surface of one of these drums. There have been a lot of varying stories. Some of the earlier names with a fair amount of authenticity would be names like Mr. Winston Spree. However, I usually like to start the development at the point where the whole concept was orchestrated. In this respect, Mr. Ellie Manet, I think, is the name that should be associated with the inception of this activity. Mr. Ellie Manet orchestrated the steel band by actually giving all the orchestral tones to different instruments down the range from the highest to the lowest, as is found in conventional series. He therefore provided the steel band with the potentialities of total orchestration. From there, he expanded further, giving things as timbre distinction and adding a lot of other features which made tuning easier, gave better, richer tones to the instrument, and provided us with all we really needed to present this to the music world. We think that now it is a legitimate instrument with potentialities of challenging qualities, and we think it's capable of doing exactly what other musical instruments do.
One of the unique things about steel drums is that it's a sound that wasn't created to be an instrument. It's a sound that was found in steel drums that contained other things inside. It had a function other than being an instrument. But now people like yourself are making it as instruments, not to hold oil in or whatever.
It may be safe to say in that way that maybe the steel band benefited from some of the dividends of our technology, because the perfecting of the empty drum, of the drum itself, wasn't for the purpose of an instrument. It was for a container. And we receive our starting material in a very advanced form. because the process of manufacturing the cylindrical drum is already perfected by the manufacturers for that purpose. And we don't have to worry about saying that, because even though the steel band becomes very popular, they will still have to make those drums for their industrial purposes. Mankind is stuck with that 55-gallon drum. He's stuck with it because it's the ideal size for his shipping and receiving type industrial product. He can't make it smaller. He can't change the shape, you know. If he makes it square, he can't roll it along the wharves and so on and so forth. They can't do anything to it. So they're really stuck with that. So it's quite safe to say that we came out lucky by, you know, getting those dividends, having the drums already made and already perfected. What we could do now, we could make certain recommendations, like I've been doing research on different metals, like different alloys and so on and so forth, to see whether we could have different timber songs, or different timber, I should say, from the different instruments, to the extent of the difference would be you will hear in passing from a flute to a violin to a clarinet, you know. We like to have that type of distinction amongst our instruments in a certain range.
Why don't you go up and demonstrate for us?
Okay. You would agree that this instrument is the single lead, equivalent to like a lead violin. Okay, I play that same range, that same chord on the double instrument, which is the same as the single, except that we have now spread the notes over two surfaces. Now, you may notice that although they sound different, they sound like steel drums. You know, one steel drum sounds like another one, but it doesn't sound like anything else. On the other hand, a trumpet sounds very much different to a flute, to a violin, you know. And I think that one field left for expansion is to find a means of getting that sort of a criteria in one treble range, for example, whereby they could pick up different sounding instruments and thereby even justify our efforts to orchestration.
The steel drums that you brought with you today, mm-hmm. Did you manufacture them? Are they initially from corporate steel cans?
Yeah. Now, these instruments are manufactured by the gentleman who does my tuning. We started it, he was about 10 when I started, you know, we started as kids together. He went into tuning, I went into like the music aspect of it. And he's now one of the top tuners of the steel drum. He's part of my little company called US Steel, Unlimited Sound of Steel Orchestra. And he's based in San Francisco. And I think I explained to you the reason why we were there is for the climate. You see, these things have to be tuned outdoor. And because it's a nuisance to listen to. A nuisance sound listening to one of these things being tuned. And you find that in the wintertime here, you'll have to stay in somebody's basement, which is not going to be very, you know, permissible. So in this summer, where it's always warm, we could stay in a junkyard all year round, you know, and just keep making them. So it's easier for production. And eventually, I know for a fact that if this does become a real commercial marketable entity and mass production becomes the key, then it's easy to have factories built where these things could be manufactured in indoor, you know. But right now, we just have to like makeshift, you know, in the manufacturing process. Now, these were made in California, and to answer the question you asked, we were able to grab these drums off the assembly line right off before they were even sent to the shipping people who want to put, I think, benzene. They were used for benzene purposes. We got them before they were shipped, so they were never used as containers, you see. I'm still questioning the advantage of that, you know, because I got very good instruments from drums that were already used as containers. It seems as though the weight of the liquid inside the drum sort of stabilizes the bottom of it. And these notes are made from the bottom, not the top, as people think, you know. The top will have that hole in it for the stuff to come out. These drums are really made from the bottom. The instruments are really made from the bottom of the original drums. And it seems as though, excuse me, the bottom part of the instrument is reinforced to sustain that great high hydraulic pressure or the weight. And for that purpose, you find that we get better songs from instruments that are, or rather challenging songs from instruments, from drums that were previously used as containers.
Well, I'd like to ask you to go back to the drums again and give us some more of a demonstration of the kinds of sounds that you can get and the different forms of music that you have been using to play on them.
Now, this is the... You notice that this has the very, very high notes. We go from C to another octave to a third octave. You see? And we try to use this single drum, which I call a single soprano, to play more the parts of a lead, the lead violin. Okay, the reason why we crowd all the notes on one surface here is because you can get more manipulation. It's easier to manipulate the whole scale or the whole range when you have all the notes crowded on one surface. Okay, we noticed that by having the notes crowded onto one surface, we have they're more within the reach of the player, and he could do much more, much faster, much more complex manipulations than he could possibly do with the spread on the surfaces of the double instrument, as this one over here. Now, however, the double instrument has its advantages, which mainly lies in the fact that by having the notes spread on two surfaces, we have more tonal possibilities. For example, we could select the notes that would reinforce each other and place them on one surface and put the others on the other surface. To demonstrate that, you notice that we have the coupling of notes. We put the first and the third, major third, of every scale on the same surface. The full chord will, the third, the full chord will come. And by having them on two surfaces also, we are able to introduce four lower tones which sort of reinforce the overall song. That we have a deep, richer tone without sacrificing the original clear melodic sound of the higher register. This is the same double instrument. You know, that sounds like you could hear the clear ring of the high notes there. Still present in the presence of the lower tones. Like I could play that same bit here at a lower register on this instrument. You see, it's the same thing but played one octave below. That's the advantage of the double surfaces. Did I make that clear?
Yeah, for people who are listening now who can't see the steel drums and haven't seen one before, I should say that the surface of them is concave, and there are divisions in this concave surface, and each of those divisions is a different note. So there are divisions around the periphery of the surface, and then in the center, there are small circles that form a larger circle a line together, and each one of those surfaces is also a note. And I'm wondering how you get them to be notes.
What you said a while ago is very good, but let me see if I could say it again.
Yeah, go ahead.
It is concave, it's concave because the first process in the tuning of these instruments is to stretch the surface inwards under quite intense hammering. Now, many people ask, why don't we just get it molded in such a way that it is already stretched before, you know, we start tuning? That wouldn't be possible because musical song come from a tension induced on a stretched string, for example, a violin. You have to actually induce that tension. You won't have the same effect if you were to buy the violin string already stretched, you know. So that's the same process we are going here. We go through here. We actually induce that tension onto the surface by stretching it inwards. We get it to vibrate. You get that vibrating type effect. Now, when we do that, we then subdivide the surface by making partial grooves. We don't actually perforate the surface. We just actually subdivide it into segments of varying sizes. The varying sizes represent varying tones. The sizes vary because the lower the tone, the larger the area, which follows. You know, like deeper tones always come from larger strings on a piano or anything. And the smaller segments represent higher frequencies or higher notes, higher sounding notes. And that's the reason why the surface seems to be pitted or like subdivided into so many little parts. So up to that point, you could see that we have actually stretched the surface and actually subdivided the surface into a predetermined pattern. That pattern is a set standard pattern. We know exactly the sizes of these things based on a mold that we have, you know, a stencil. And you notice that if I make another pair or have another pair made, they could be superimposable in this pair because we're using the same pattern each time. Now, you like to know how then do we induce, how do we introduce the tones, the tuning, okay? Now, if you could envisage the surface of any one segment as, let's say, a string of a violin, you could see how we could actually use that very same concept and introduce more tension into an area or less as is desired. I'll stretch it some more or relax it some more until we get the correct frequency.
Now, was this initially discovered by accident? I mean, back about 30 years ago, I guess it was, when people in Trinidad started using steel drums. Mm-hmm. I mean, the notes were not already made. I mean, how do you think that was stumbled upon?
Okay, no, that's interesting. I remember how they were when they started, what the steel bands were like. They were smaller things. We held them in our hands and, you know, we played four notes on the surfaces, you see. And I remember also that after the war, Second World War, you know, there were a lot of celebrations, like street dances and festivities. And people were actually parading the streets and being beaten on the bottom of cans and so on and so forth. And I think that has contributed considerably to the cultural or musical evolution of the people of Trinidad. With the carnival, the nation's annual carnival, I think that stimulated the proliferation of the concept because it brought an answer to something that they always wanted to do. There weren't enough string bands and conventional bands to go around for the general participation of carnival. And it is possible that this may have been stimulated by its need for the carnival celebrations. They stumbled upon this, I think, by the fact that once you have a concept which seems very rudimentary, somebody could build on that concept. And you could see that if it starts with just two tones, how it is easy to try three, easy to try four. And how it is easy to try the four that would be most valuable to any type of rendition. And then why not try the scale? And then why not try two octaves? You know, and then I could see exactly, you could see how it could grow from there. And you could see that right at this point, it has reached its limit because anything further, besides the timbre distinction that we spoke about earlier, you know, between the different drums, like a flute as against a clarinet, you know, besides that need, there's not much need for the tuners to keep experimenting anymore. No, they need assistance and attention, you know, because they have done a fantastic job so far. And you find that now tuners are actually getting frustrated. They don't know what to invent next. Like, they have nine piece basses and so on and so forth, and they're creating fantastic tones. And I think that what they're doing this because they're up against a wall. You know, they have actually reach the top level in achievement. You see, they cannot go beyond what music demands. You know, they cannot go outside what is controlled or regulated by the laws or the basic concept of music itself. Incidentally, it is the fact that we use these instruments to play music as we know it that is making the correlation possible. You see, the two concepts are brought together by the fact that they're both used for interpreting the same thing. And you find that music will impose limitations on the steel band as it did on the other instruments.
Well, maybe this would be a good time to listen to some music. You've brought with you a few very different types of steel drum recordings. Sure. Let's start listening to a recording of steel band music that I think is the kind of music that most people associate with the music that you hear steel drums playing. It's from one of the Nonesuch Traveler series recordings of steel band music. Do you want to say a few words about this before we hear it?
I prefer to say something after we hear it.
Fine, okay, let's hear it first. Just heard the Trinidad Steel Band playing A High Life, and if you're just tuning in, I'm in the studio with John Gibbs, who participates in the manufacturing of steel drums, plays steel drums, has written a book about steel drums, and is in the studio with me now. John, before we hear a couple of other different types of steel band recordings, what can you tell us about the kind of music that we just heard? You must have played that when you were younger.
Oh, yes. Quite frankly, that is the way that all steel band players would, in fact, start. You can see that's the typical sound of a steel band. It must have been recorded maybe in the West Indies. You could see that, again, that... the type of music that they did play was more of the island type music, more like a calypso type music, which is really what one would expect a steel band to play. My only comments on that would be that you could see that not much recording, production, engineering was put into it and so on and so forth. There wasn't any heavy type production work that is typical of modern day recording. So that type of recording, although it is a very good document or very representative of what a steel band is like, would have a very weak chance of being selected or it's for having its candidacy considered for playing on a commercial type station. Now I know that people would like to think that the steel band in its original form is the way they like to hear it, you know. And if that's the case, well, they have no problems because that's all there is, right, up to this point, that type of recording, the actual native type music. And although they might sell to the wanderer what goes into a music store, they are by no means competitive, you know, and you're not going to make it anywhere from a financial point of view, sticking to that type of music. Now, if you try to expand it, your original concept of music could never leave you. That is still with you, but now you're just trying other avenues to see whether you could boost the monetary aspect of the endeavor.
Let's listen to another one of the recordings that you brought with you. This is a group called the Bell Tones.
Yeah.
We'll listen to it, and then you can tell us a little about it. Thank you. Well, that was a very different kind of sound than the one we heard from the Trinidad Steel Band. That was a group called the Belltones who recorded that in New York in, what, about 1965, was it?
I think it's around the 1965. I'm familiar with those musicians. Some of them did work with me for a while, you know. Well, you could see in that record that a little bit more effort was made into actually producing a record. There seemed to be more planning there. You could see that we got clearer to what... We were getting a little closer to what we would normally expect from a recording. You see, although you could capture musical songs on a record and make it sound like music, it's a difference when you could capture it and make it sound like a record. Some recordings are just mere documents, you know, of one's effort, and others, on the other hand, are designed as marketable entities.
I'm beginning to sense that you see a record as being something very different from music.
Yeah,
a record
sure.
is what you make because it sells and it gets played on the radio, and music is what you make because you like making it and it sounds good.
Because of your artistic guidance and your urge to actually play music itself under the rules of music. To make a record, you have to actually disobey some of the rules of music. You have to do things that are unbelievable in the studio, but you are just trying to make a recording. Easy. And in a studio, musicians, you don't look for talent, you look for competence. You know, it's slightly different. You know, because it's actually that you're actually adapting or presenting or modifying, or you could say, what your knowledge of music is towards the purpose of making the recording, but also sacrificing your original concept of music, you see. That's why studio musicians are studio musicians, and they usually remain that way for quite a while, you know, as against entertainers who play live music, you know, they're also a different group, you know. It's not easy to take a band and take them into studio. I don't use my musicians to record. I do all my parts, all the steel band parts, not because of, and for no other reason than you have to learn so many different things in a studio to get it to sound like a product, that they'll be learning 50 or 60 versions of one song, and I'll be still asking them to go and do a live show and remember the correct one. You know, that's much too complicated, you see. And I just usually try to minimize the amount of participation I have from the full group for recording purposes, you know.
Well, John, let's listen to a recording that you brought with you today, and then we'll talk about it after we've heard it. This is from John's recording, which is called the complete album title is called John Gibbs and the Unlimited Sound of Steel Orchestra, and it's on the Makossa label. And let's listen to one of these recordings. Thank you. you're just joining us now, my guest in the studio is John Gibbs, who is a steel drum player, a steel drum manufacturer, and also a writer about steel drums. We've just heard an excerpt from his new album, which is called John Gibbs and the Unlimited Sound of Steel Orchestra. The album's called Steel Funk, and we heard one of his own tunes called Trinidad and Tobago. And before hearing this, we heard a couple of other steel drum tunes. This, you were talking about, you know, commercial sounds and what radio stations will play. Surely what you have made is the one that comes closest to that. And can you talk to us about, given what we were talking about before, the difference between what you see as being what you play because you're playing music and what you play because you're recording it and it's going to be an album, and the album has to be marketable.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about the production?
Well, yeah, sure. In this album that I did here, we had to struggle to find the delicate balance between the actual sound of the steel band and the sound of the conventional instruments. We were forced to introduce it. Actually, we planned it this way. We had to do it this way because it was the only method that seemed practical at the time for introducing a brand new sound. Now, whenever you're listening to music on the air or listening to music and you don't have the visual concept to stimulate you, you can't really afford any time to actually figure out what instrument you're listening to. People appreciate music much more readily when they could recognize in their minds, when they could recognize the instruments. You actually have a visual type pattern going along in your mind when you hear trumpets and violins, because you know what they look like and how they're being played, and it does help in your appreciation of the music. And when they hear a strange sound coming through, you know, the radio, let's say, and it might be beautiful, but it's supposed to be that way, they will spend time trying to figure it out, what they're listening to, and by the time they do figure it out, the record will be over. And you find that in commercial music, R&B music, if you want to call it that way, which is just a very tiny adaptation of a part of the art form in modern day trends, you know, it's not we know what it is really. We know that commercial music is a big sacrifice we have to make to get a record to sound like a record. Once we start dealing with commercial recordings, we are dealing with a completely different aspect of the whole subject. Now, we are concerned about making money. Now, to do that, you're competing with other marketable items. A car might be, nobody looks at the inside, the engine of a car. If it doesn't have a strip of chrome, it comes without the chrome or the hubcaps, you're not going to buy it. You know, it's the finishing touches, these things that really catch the eye. So therefore, there are ways of marketing, there are standard ways of making recordings. And if you want your product to be competitive, you got to at least try to make it close to the standard. Now, to make it close to the standard, you have to please look at some of the basic features in all recordings that you must have. There's certain fundamental features that nearly every recording must have to really get the attention from a listener. And we had to pick these out and see how we could dovetail them in with the sound of the steel drum and try to present it. Now, the next record is going to have a little bit more of the steel drum and less of the conventional, until we might be able to change the balance all the way around.
So what you have done in this album is take what is a popular form of commercial music now, and have, well, write the tune, which is a really nice tune, and then have this steel drum play the lead on it. It might have been a piano if someone else had written and recorded it.
Yeah, sure, definitely.
So you're like taking the steel drum out of its island context and putting it into like American commercial music and just having it play.
Oh yeah, okay, fine. No, let me say one thing about that. It was not only by having other instruments that made this recording sound the way it did. Mainly it was due to the fact that the style of playing was changed. Rather than playing the percussive downbeat as the average steel band player would do, you notice either you couldn't pick up too much of the impact. I actually had the notes sustaining and flowing like this, like a bow. This took a lot of practicing, and we had to develop the technique of grace notes in such an extent that you can't really pick up the actual impact of the pulses, you know. I have to remove the percussive style from the instrument.
I would like it if you could go back to the drums now and play the melody of the piece that we just heard alone, so we could just hear the drums playing it.
Okay, sure. That's what I had to do there. I had to use a technique whereby you wouldn't hear you wouldn't hear this. Right. No, that technique was to actually hold the drumsticks differently. Like instead of grabbing hold of the drumstick as a drummer would, I actually let the drumsticks fall on the surface. You see. Get a gliding smooth sound.
It's a lovely tune.
I'm glad you like it.
It seems to me that you're working on a lot of angles.
Because
in your book you talk about, you know, all the conductors, the famous classical conductors who'd come down to Trinidad for the steel drum festivals, and some of them would be absolutely astounded, and some of them would say, well, it's all obviously very limited.
Yeah.
You're trying to reach them too, and when you were warming up, what were you playing? You were playing Bach, I mean.
So It's strange. Like the steel band players, inventors, the tuners, I think that their goal, they had their eyes set on the big classical type song. And luckily they did that, because by aiming there, they covered all the ground of tones and so on and so forth. And once they got there, you know that not too many musicians would like to, not too many conventional musicians from a symphony orchestra would like to come and see. You know that you are doing the same thing that you know that we are doing. You know, people rather consider the steel band as, you know, a folk like type thing. You know, and once they start to get into folk music, they have to really consider the extent to which folk benefited from music itself, or vice versa. You know, like it seems as though that folk music have accepted lots of things, or through seepage, things like you have the metric pattern, well-defined phrases, you have tonality, a little bit of modality, you have triadic intervals. You know, most the folk music of the Western world now seems to be under the guidance of the art itself, and therefore there's no real reason for people to like restrict any type of innovation and put it in a class and call it folk as against artistic music and so on and so forth, because the concept of the steel band, if it is examined really in detail or mechanistically, you will notice that there are some very, very clever concepts emerging out of it. Concepts that we wondered whether the early inventors would not have found a use for this concept to the extent of even introducing it in preference over some of the things that they wrote for. They're interesting things about the steel band that make playing certain things easier than even on conventional instruments. And one is the fact that both hands are used for doing the same thing. In a majority of instruments, whereas one hand is positioning or forming the note, like shortening the string in a string instrument, while the other hand songs it, you see, you have two different coordinating mechanisms in the case of a conventional instrument. In the case of the steel band, both hands are doing the same thing. There's that equality. And therefore, the brain has more time to concentrate on actually playing and forming the correct tones the way you want them. And next thing about the steel band is that the notes are fixed. You don't have to worry about too much fingering position and correct breathing things and so on and so forth. Just strike it and you get the correct note. So that is another thing that they don't have to worry about. They don't have to think and then play the note. They just have to find it and song it. That's another advantage. The next thing, too, might be the fact that the notes are not chromatically arranged. They're arranged in an order which relates to the way musical tones combine. I always say that just as collars, you know, the way we dress, the way we bring certain colors in our attire together so that it looks pleasing. In just the same way, we find that certain notes in musical scales go very nicely together. And that's the way the instrument is really arranged.
Can you play the notes in the order that they are spaced?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So we could get a sense of what what you're saying sounds, how it sounds?
Oh yeah, I'm saying on the outer circumference, we have one octave, the lower octave. Now, on the inner circumference, right up towards the inside of this outer band of notes, we have the octave higher. Okay. So therefore, you find them in concentric circles. The outer band, the lower register, and as you go towards the center, they get higher in octaves. And it's the same principle on both surfaces. We find that although the notes are not arranged like on a keyboard, and it's not really possible to arrange them in a chromatic order or in order of a keyboard, because we are dealing with a circular system, not a linear one. Therefore, this might be equivalent to taking a keyboard and bringing it around and joining the two ends, right? Then, depending on where you start, you will be finding a chromatic order, yes or no, you see? And you also would notice that the point about any instrument is to familiarize yourself with the arrangement of the notes. That's a prerequisite before you can start playing it. And once you learn that pattern, you find that this pattern is easier to remember, because you don't have to figure out intervals as you change keys, because as you change keys, you know that the neighboring notes are going to be related to that key, you know. So you find it much easier that, I think, the host of a conventional instrument. Like a gentleman said to me once, how would I know where middle C is? And I asked him if I gave him a trumpet, if he could sound middle C, you know. Okay. And, you know, that's just an example of how people, how you could use a host of conventional examples to show that the same impracticality that they're trying to relate to the steel band exists in the other instruments as well, you know. Once in London, in Guildford University, I gave a lecture on the steel band. And at the end of the lecture, I didn't have my band with me, nor did I have any instruments, too much weight, you know, to take across the Atlantic Ocean. I ran into a problem because I played tapes. And there were tapes of some classical recordings that I have done. And at the end of the lecture, somebody was being very funny when they said, you're not trying to tell us that music we've been listening to is from one of your barrels, you know, something of that nature, you know. And I just asked him, well, if it didn't sound like the steel drum, what did it sound like? You know, now he found himself in a spot there, because anything he had to say would have been complimentary to the sound of the steel band. But he'd be saying, no, it sounds like a harp. Fine, I'm glad it sounds like a harp. That's what I wanted to sound like. And that just goes to show that the sound, people tend to find out what it reminds you of. They say, it reminds me of a piano. It's very different to the sound of a piano. If I could bring a piano in here now, you'd be surprised to know very different. It sounds like nothing but like another steel drum. It's just another interesting sound.
So what you, I guess, are trying to do now is let people know that, you know, let people who listen to, who buy, and who play music, that the steel drum is an instrument and is as flexible as any other.
Yeah.
So how much progress are you making?
Oh, a lot. Because
how far has it come?
I have working with me Mr. Louis Lees, who is an arranger, who does the arranging for the studio work, the orchestration. And he's a graduate of Temple, and we have applied the theory of music. So my parts could be written, and they could be played as could be played for any other instrument. And that's a great advance. And we have the engineer, Mr. Dave Marciades. He's from here in Philadelphia, from Frankfurt Wayne, one of the top ones. And he spent 5 years trying with this to get the perfect method of, you know, recording it also.
You do perform in the area.
Uh-huh.
What kind of music do you play?
One advantage of the steel band, we noticed that if we have a hit record out, we could do a show and don't even play that hit record. Because, you know, the shows we do, the visual excitement, you know, from from listening and looking at the group play, compensates for any expectations, you know. That's another thing we should say about recordings. They're usually geared to let people buy it, to the extent that when they see the artist, they don't care whether it's the artist performs good or not, you know. They already go screaming their heads off. No, that's not where I'm going, you know. I don't intend to have to be dragged around arenas and things like that, playing for masses, you know. I just went the way of making a commercial recording to get the attention of international stations that would play it, so that we could actually do tours and get the attention of a wide spectrum, you know, of people. When we do live shows, I have an opportunity to do classics. I take the audience through quite a range, you know, of moods. I keep them pretty busy, from Latin American, which they expect the conventional things, to heavy R&B songs, to the vocal songs, and so on and so forth, which is the ideal way to put a show together with something of this type. I could tell you also that hadn't I not tried to diversify, a steel band concert could become very monotonous, and people will listen to this today, but they won't come back and hear it again tomorrow. You see, because that's another, people say, oh, I've heard steel bands before. Well, what is wrong with hearing it again? You see, it's people.
Well, that comes out of seeing it as a novelty.
A novelty.
You
know, yeah.
No one says, well, I've heard a flute before, I'm not going to go exactly, see exactly. The flautist tonight.
Yeah, right. That's what I was trying to get in their minds, that you don't just have to hear it once and think that you have, you know. You're satisfied with just one performance. We have to keep making make a living off of this thing eventually.
Yeah.
And we hope.
Well, John, I want to thank you for being here. I very much admire all this work that you're doing, and I think it's very exciting to start thinking of the steel drum as a new instrument. I mean, that dawned on me reading your book, that, wow, there's there's a new instrument on the scene. It's not that new. It's been around for a while, and I'm kind of excited to keep my ears open to see what happens with it, to see what we can start hearing in new forms of sound and new forms of music that might arise.
Yeah, well, it was a pleasure, I mean, speaking with you on your program. I rather enjoyed it. You know, you gave me a chance to say things that I always wanted to say, you know, to lots more people than I could possibly have done, you know, back home in my basement. And it was really an interesting program. And I think that this does show another aspect or open up another avenue for the type of work that I'm trying to do.
Well, I should mention that if anyone is interested in reading about steel band music, John has written a book called The Unit Steel Band. And then there's this album that we heard a little earlier, which is called Steel Funk. Thanks again, John, for being here.
Thank you very much.